You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
The India Program and the Education Support Program are delighted that you could come today to share in the work of Nafsanjan Trust.
Sure.
I first learned about Nafsanjan Trust about 2.5 years ago when I first joined the organization. Through the writings of a professor at Teachers College, Columbia University, who does work on peace education and human rights education. And she'd written a book on human rights education in India. And when I read about this organization, we reached out to her to ask her if she could connect us with Martin and Manjula, who's the executive director of the organization. And we invited them to Nepal to join a workshop there. And when they arrived, we were even more fascinated by the breadth and the depth of the work that they do, because even though we're engaged with them around questions of education, their work spans many more areas. And I think what is most fascinating to me about their work is just the depth of and the connectedness to the grassroots and the communities that they serve in this work that they do. And so it's a pleasure to have you here today. Once we heard that Martin was going to be in New York on other business, we thought we must grab him and have him share with our colleagues in some of the work that he's doing. So without further ado, I'd like us to start. But we wanted to start with a short 3-minute clip of a documentary film. It's actually the trailer to the film. And we have the filmmaker, Tane Murray, here with us today. And she would be on hand to answer any other questions that you have. I want to stress that this is but one slice of the experience of what it means to be Dalit in India, and it focuses particularly on Dalit women. And so without further ado, I'm going to play this, and I should warn that it's quite graphic.
India. Behind its piety.
Thank you very much, Tane Murray. Martin, as I mentioned, this is but one slice of what it means to be Dalit. Put this into a broader context for us and help us understand it, because there's some people who would say caste is not alive anymore in India. Put this into context for us and help us understand what it means to be Dalit in India.
Well, number one, that people sometimes say that it's a minority, but they constitute around 16.5% of the Dalit population of Indian population, which means around 180 million people. Well, when people say that, you know, caste is not alive, often what they use an example is, for example, saying that the president of India was a Dalit, you know, 5 years back. But this is what I want to share with you today, that Dalit is not a homogeneous community. In India, about 751 subcastes are there within Dalits. And so you might find people within the Dalit community who have been able to educate themselves and become a judge of the High Court or a Supreme Court or become the President of India. But on the other hand, you will have thousands of people. For example, we have 750,000 people in India who are what we call the manual scavengers. This is the lowest within the caste hierarchy, even among Dalits. And we all know that according to 2011 census of India, only 36% of Indian population have access to sanitation systems. That means of 1.25 billion people, 66% or 64% people who don't have access to sanitation system, where do they go to answer nature's call? So in rural society, you know, they allocate, demarcate a small plot of land, one for man and one for woman, where everybody defecates. And then who will clean it? It is the job of the manual scavengers. And what they have is something like, you know, two plates with which they pick it up and they put into their bamboo baskets and then carry it on their heads, dump it outside the village. And when it is raining, you can see the whole thing dribbling on their faces and bodies. This is India 2014, right? irrespective of a lot of progress and everything which is made. But let me give you another example. You know, India, which is a definitely a shining model and a economy which the world cannot ignore anymore. But within the Dalits, for example, there's a subcaste, a community called Mushahars in Bihar. And one of the principal source of livelihood is eating rats from the farm. Very poor community, but the literacy rate among Mushahar women is 0.46% today. So only two women in 100 can read and write. So this is the disparity, right? So when we say Dalits, you know, we must take into all this into consideration. But what we saw in the film is one side of the story, that there is something which is visible, the violence, but something which is not visible. So for example, you come to any Indian village, the segregated housing colonies, all Dalits are outside the village. If you have drinking water well, all the wells are separate. All the burial grounds and cemeteries are separate. And this is so untouchability and discrimination continues to be the major issue, and there everybody suffers, whether you are educated or whether you are illiterate, right? So even if a person becomes a highest police officer, his or her house continues to be in a segregated Dalit locality. This is what the caste.
And so use that to talk to us about the mission of NAFSAJAN and the way in which the organization emerged. One of your core missions is ending discrimination against Dalits and ending untouchability, essentially. Talk to us about the genesis of your organization and give us a kind of a thumbnail sketch of the areas of work that you're engaged in.
Well, it's a long story to be in brief, you know. Way back in 1970, a group of professors who also taught me in the college started a center, small center called Behavioral Science Center at Ahmedabad, drawn from the learning of the famous American psychologist called David McClelland and his work on achievement motivation, and the learnings drawn from Paulo Freire from Brazil and Sigmund Freud, the whole theory of the exploring the unconscious mind of the human, because that is where it is all stored up. The approach was to educate the community who believed that caste system basically is a creation of God, to tell them that it is not so, it is a human intervention, it is a human creation. Well, people's belief is totally not unfounded, because in 3000 years back, in one of the holy scriptures called Vedas, you find the reference that the creator made the Brahmins out of the head and the warrior caste out of the arms and the tradesmen from the belly and the Shudras, the locals, from the feet, and therefore the, you know, they should serve the other three. Now this is a belief system in which people believe that I'm born a Dalit because I committed sins in the previous birth, and if I continue to do good work, which is fall in line basically, then I have the chance to have a better life in the next birth. Well, this is how we started. But I remember when I went to the village for the first time, I saw upper caste man entering any Dalit woman's house and do anything what they want with the women, and nobody could protest. That's what I saw with my own eyes. I was 17 then. Well, the government said, you know, a farm worker working for 8 hours must earn 7 rupees, but people were paid only 1 rupee. You couldn't ride a bicycle. The women were not allowed to put on the footwear, you know, when they went to fetch water at the well. The man could not go in the village unless you have a turban tied on your head. Now, this was the severe kind of exploitation, you know, system. So out of this, we built, you know, both an economic kind of project where, so that people don't have to depend so much on the so-called dominant castes, right? Because it was dependence which made them vulnerable to, exploitation. Well, when people started getting more money and, you know, they started protesting on all this, and we were able to raise that 1 rupee wage to 15 rupees, you know, and more work to other villages, the dominant caste felt that, you know, well, if this goes further, we are going to lose all our privileges. So do one thing, just attack and finish all the leaders at one go. So there was a massive attack on the community where I worked, and four of my colleagues were shot dead. Two died later, 18 were wounded, the whole locality was burned on fire, 1986. Well, of course, we fought the legal case, we got life imprisonment for the first time in the state to 14 people, a big fight which brought down the violence. But that made me realize the biggest lesson I learned in my life is that caste is not an issue between two individuals. It's a systemic issue, and therefore if you want to fight a system, you know, you have to have a very broad-based organization. So 1989 we set up Nav Sajan Trust, which is going to complete 25 years. It's working in 3,000 villages in Gujarat, but on education, on land reforms, implementation of minimum wages, women's leadership, primary education, vocational education, you know, because when you are poor and marginalized, you can't say, okay, this is the best door for me. You cannot afford closing any window, right? You have to be a multi-approach kind of thing, you know. So that's what Nav Sajan is trying to do about it, right? It does research, you know, and for the last 25 years, I think it has become a good model, you know, for others. How do you address the question of caste, right? And I would just say, add one more thing, is that the what is very important is the approach. So a lot of people believe that, you know, violence is the way. And many Dalits also will say, you know, they have told me again and again that, you know, oh, well, if they rape our women, we must rape their women. And the question I asked them was, well, if I also believe that I can rape women, I want to understand the difference between Dalit and the non-Dalit. Right? And therefore, you know, our approach is, number one, constitutional. Second is educational. Right? This is what the whole approach is about, and social. Right? So, only law doesn't help. The people who suffer must come together. Right? As we saw in the film, if you don't protest, nobody takes notice of it. So, the educational approach is a precondition.
So talk a little bit more about that, because you're saying only the law doesn't help. We know that litigation is one of the tools that you use, but describe for us the kinds of strategies that you use to directly challenge instances of discrimination, whether they occur in terms of wages, in terms of land rights, in terms of women's rights, in terms of education.
Well, I remember one thing is in a district called Surendranagar in Gujarat. When we started our office, some people came to the office and said, you know, we have a land problem. That means we have been given land, but the land is not with us. Actually, after independence, we had two major land reform legislations in India. And the Swedish Nobel laureate Gunnar Myrdal said that those were the one of the most revolutionary legislations anywhere in South Asia. Well, the law said that, number one, if you are a tenant, if you have been cultivating the land yourself, you get the first right to purchase. And secondly, second law says that it's called Ceiling Act. You cannot have any individual more than a certain specific amount of land. If you have more than that, that goes back to the government for redistribution to Dalits and tribals. Now, the most successful land reforms in India that happened, actually it favored the so-called dominant caste who were poor. So you have in India, for example, in the US, one of the caste which is called Patel, which is the most powerful dominant caste, you know, who were earlier Shudras, and you know, they were treated as low caste, and they were landless agriculture workers. But the land reforms helped them to get land, become landowners, and therefore they would travel to USA, UK, and today they are one of the most dominant caste. Unfortunately, when it came to implementation of the law for the Dalits and tribals, everybody had developed cold feet. Now in this Surendranagar district, you know, we surveyed 250 villages and we found 6,000 acres of land which was given to people, say 25 years back, but they had no possession of it. So we wrote to the government, and government as usual says, well, we need to investigate. Anything you say to the government, the first thing is we need to investigate, right? Well, what we did is, we did first a survey, a thorough survey, which no fact, and based on the government records, so the government cannot say, oh, this record is false. We had drawn the figures from their own offices and came up with a petition saying this village, this person, by this land order, given this much of land, which he doesn't have or she doesn't have it. So, number one, your documentation and research has to be thorough. Nobody can challenge your authenticity. With that, we had two approaches. One, we mobilize the community. For example, you know, when we signed the petition, about 8,000 people signed the petition saying, oh, this land must be given to us. And we were very upbeat, saying, you know, people are ready. And then we organized a public protest march. And when the march happened, I went to the site. There were two people, and they were the parents of one of my colleagues. And 150 policemen with the guns to protect us. Everybody had the fear that there's going to be shootout. Mm. Well, it was such a frustrating kind of thing, but we didn't give up. We started going back to the village and educating people that fear is our most dreaded enemy, and you have to address the question of fear. When we had the second program, we got 400 people. The third program, 1,500. And when we had the fourth program, there were 30,000 people on the street. You know, but that requires going to house, door to door, you know. When government saw that, they realized that you have to do something. And as I lightly say, you know, for a politician, a person may be untouchable, but the vote is not untouchable, and every political party wants that vote, mm-hmm. right? So they don't want to lose their votes, and 16.5% of votes in India. With that, third approach was we went to the federal court, or what as we call the high court in the state, and we filed a class action suit on the matter. Well, within 6 months, we got the order that the government must appoint surveyors in all the villages on priority basis immediately and hand over all the land. It took us 5 years of struggle, but we got 6,000 acres of land for the community. Now we are fighting for maybe another 12,000 acres of land. Yeah. So this is one example, right? How do you use the law? How do you mobilize the community, right? And how do you force the state, right, to do something which is your right? It's not something that we are asking, something which is unjust.
I'll ask a couple more questions and then kind of open it up for colleagues. But I wanted to build on this idea of mobilizing communities. You talk about showing up at your first protest and there were two people and building to 30,000. And the idea of social movements being behind the weight of the litigation that you do is extremely important. And it's a lesson that we're learning here ourselves within OSF when we think of the DH case, for instance. One of the questions I want to ask has to do with the coalitions of these civil society groups, this movement behind you. Naftajan works not just on behalf of Dalits. You work across caste lines. You work with Muslims. You work with tribal populations. You work with what your constitution refers to as other backward classes. And often, if we think in terms of our own work at OSF across issues and trying to build a coalition of people to speak to an issue that commonly affects them, it often is difficult finding that common ground and holding people there. So, for instance, if we think of the question of inclusion in Europe, for instance, and we try to bring together Roma people with disabilities, sometimes we're so deeply entrenched in our own issues that it becomes hard to see past that to our common language. When you think about bringing together all these different groups, how do you find that common language, and what do you see as some of the challenges that you face in bringing them together for this kind of work?
Well, you see, we call it that caste is a conspiracy which is used to divide the poor people in India. So 75% of the people who are poor, but they're divided vertically and horizontally on the caste and the religious lines, right? They have the same problems. You have agricultural laborers in all castes. You have women, the you know, victims of violence, domestic violence across caste, right? You have problem of land alienation across caste. And I remember my first such meeting in with Manjula in one of our you know villages where we set up a trade union of the farm workers. Well, 90% of in the village were farm workers, but they were tribals, they were Dalits, and they were the so-called other backward caste, the OBC. When we had the meeting, I and Manjula were sitting, and one group was on the right side, one was on the left side, one group was on the roof. We are all suffering from the same thing, but we cannot sit together because that group is lower than us. and we are higher than them. You know, this is what. Well, it took us a lot of time to tell people that unless everybody becomes equal, the right to equality cannot become a moral ground of enforcement. To be able to say that I'm equal, I must practice equality. Right? And that takes a long time. It doesn't happen overnight, right? Now, you know, what happened is, for example, we have heard those stories in India that in 2004 there were very infamous communal riots in Gujarat. You know, the violence mm-hmm. that was perpetrated against the Muslim Wadli community, maybe more than 2,000 people dead and thousands missing still. And how many people are homeless, there's no idea about it. Now, some of the Dalit groups, it was claimed that they were instigated by the political parties and the tribals to be at the forefront attacking Muslims.
Some of our colleagues in the room might not know about the riots. Could you just give a little bit of background on that?
You know, I mean, there's a famous kind of agitation which is going on by the right-wing parties in India to erect a big temple on the birthplace, believed to be a birthplace of Lord Ram, the Hindu deity. It's called Ram Janmabhoomi. Now, it is claimed that the Muslims, many years back, you know, some centuries back, they demolished the temple and they built the mosque over it. Now, in a country where, you know, Hindu is a dominant force, right, how can the Muslims, you know, build a mosque or the temple? Now, Supreme Court, the highest body, legal body, appointed a commission of inquiry and it went on researching several years. But there is no evidence to suggest that there was a temple underneath the mosque. Yet in 1992, the right-wing parties mobilized thousands of people and say, let's head to that place, right, to protest. Well, it was expected that it's not going to be a very peaceful event. The local government, which was a BJP then, they promised to the Supreme Court that they will make sure that there is no law and order problem. They betrayed the promise and the crowd went on a rampage and destructed the entire mosque. Well, that sparked up the riots. And I worked personally, along with my Nausin colleagues, 4 months in Gujarat, some of the areas. And I remember that police brought two young kids to me. One was a three-year-old boy who could barely speak, and one was a six-month-old baby. And they both were thrown in the street. The boy who was 3-year-old had 32 stitches on the skull. It was, you know, open like that. And the boy said that, you know, my grandparents, my parents, and three of my sisters, they were burnt alive. The small baby, 6-month-old, you know, they had given an iron rod which is put to hot and, you know, punctured all over, so you can see the flesh coming out. Yeah. I mean, this is what level people can go through. I saw with my, I can't forget that. Well, again, that same agitation went on. And in 2004, there were another bout of riots, and this time, well-planned. I know that's what the theory says, but as we say, sometimes the truth cannot be proved because it does not have horns, that's our saying says, you know. So, the state was a perpetrator. The police did a coalition with the rioters. And there was a massive riots in Gujarat, especially, which killed. We met women. And women had taken shelter, you know, to the Hindu locality because they were neighbors for years. And Hindus said, don't worry, come on to our campus. We'll protect you here. When they went there, they realized that only men were there and there were no women there because then they had sent away the women the previous night somewhere else. Well, before they could think, the crowd started swelling. And that is the time these neighbors who had given them shelter said, sorry, we can't protect you. Please go away from here. And women said, where can we go? But the crowd, you know, they raped women. When the police were standing with the guns, they raped them and then burned them alive, putting petrol on them. Hundreds of cases, right? Well, historically, Jyotiba Phule and Savitri Phule were the first couple in Maharashtra, you know, who started education for the Dalits and the women. And when Jyotiba Phule persuaded over the British that education be made accessible to everybody, irrespective of religion and caste, make a law, including Dalits, en masse, all the teachers in the state resigned because they were Brahmins from one single community called the priestly caste, and they said to teach Dalits and women is against our religion and we will not do this. And therefore, the Muslim teachers were brought in from Uttar Pradesh, from the north, who became the first teachers to give that knowledge. Mm-hmm. Even when Gandhi began some of the schools, it were the Muslim teachers who ran the schools. So this was the cultural and social fabric between Dalits, tribals and the Muslims. Yeah. Today, if you see, there are a lot of Muslims who are there who were converted from the untouchable communities, mm-hmm. just like Christians. Now, what the right-wing party has done, they have seen, they are trying to redefine Hinduism, where they say Hindu is the one who is not a Muslim and who is not a Christian. A very simple dividing line. And this is creating a lot of tension and poisonous minds, right? And therefore, we believe that caste, when we work with a caste, it cannot be an exclusive approach. It cannot achieve anything, no matter how successful, and you might have very good stories to comment on. You have to have a very inclusive approach. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, as Ambedkar himself, Dr. Ambedkar, who was the Dalit icon during the independence movement, who wrote the Indian Constitution, said, you know, caste system, you know, is a well-designed conspiracy to divide the poor people. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you have to annihilate caste. And the program he gave was education. Not only in terms of literacy, but education which can bring all these communities together, right? Well, that's what I would...
Martin, thank you for your remarks. I wanted to open it up to give other colleagues a chance to ask questions that might allow Martin to drill down into other specific areas of their work. We've only begun to scratch the surface, and I know that some of you might actually have questions.
Sure, and I think we didn't go around the table for a round of introduction, so it would be useful if you can say the name and which program they work for.
Sure. Tom Kellogg, East Asia Program here at OSF. Thank you very much for your remarks and for taking the time to speak with us today. My question has to do with, you alluded to right-wing political parties in India, and of course we have Prime Minister Modi now. I wonder if you could say a little bit about his views on this issue. Obviously he's directly tied to the riots in Gujarat that you talked about. Is this going to be a difficult moment for Dalit rights in general and for the work of your center in particular?
Well, the politicians are a different caste by themselves, and they change their colors every moment, yep. and every time.
Yep.
At one time, it was Narendra Modi who wrote a book which they were scared and never published. But when he made a statement that scavengers are doing this work because somehow they had a moral inspiration, you know, to do that, you know, some connectedness to religion. But then they got, you know, wives, and therefore they stopped the publication of the book. Mm-hmm. But today, the language is totally different because they are in power. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they will talk language of development, inclusiveness, mm-hmm. human rights, communal harmony. All the language that the civil society was speaking, they can do much better. Mm-hmm. All the vocabulary has been adopted, right? But essentially, now what we have to see is, for example, you know, in Gujarat, where Modi was chief minister for 3 terms, that's almost 15 years. And Gujarat is one which is, you know, by population of Dalits, it is 14th in the nation in the ranking. It has 2.33% population of entire Dalit country, Dalit population of India located in Gujarat. In terms of violence against Dalits, it is ranking number 3. When it comes to violence against women, it is number 2, right? Unfortunately, with the hype of the development and all those issues are under the carpet, right? So we have to wait and see. Number 1, okay, language is not enough, right? As Gandhi and Ambedkar had a, you know, classic dilemma and confrontation, where Gandhi said, you know, you have to wait till the conscience of the other person changes. And Ambedkar said, sorry, Mr. Gandhi, The country cannot be run on conscience. You need a system in place, a law in place. So we have to see, for example, what is he doing on land reforms? What's he doing in terms of implementing minimum wages? In Gujarat, the law may be saying that, you know, you are able to get around, you should be paid around 200 rupees per day. But I have visited villages just 3 months back and they paid as low as 40 rupees, two-thirds of a dollar for 8 hours of work. Yeah. What he does in terms of manual scavenging, because 750,000 people are manual scavengers today, right? What is he doing on education? Now, the problem is, you see, the schools are there, the classrooms are there. There's no problem so far as access to education is concerned, even for Dalit children, but discrimination and quality of education continues to be a major problem, right? So in terms of, you know, I would say, well, Indian constitution has abolished untouchability, but has fallen short to abolish caste system as general. And we need to see, you know, that if you're talking of secular India, a global economy, a human right kind of thing, then you have to demonstrate and say, okay, in terms, this is what the program which is going to bring equality. I would challenge him to do so, you know, personally. And that's what we've been doing in the state for, you know, last 25 years.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question, Tom.
On this issue of quality and inclusion in education, I'm Julia Harrington Reddy. I'm from the Equality and Inclusion Program at the Justice Initiative. Actually, it's not a program, it's a cluster, but whatever. do you have good examples in India of really inclusive education across castes? Or do you have inspirations from countries other than India? Or, obviously, if you go to a school and you see all the Dalit children sitting in a corner at the back, you know that it's not inclusive. But how do you really measure whether it's inclusive or not? I mean, even in many societies, there have been studies showing that teachers are more likely to call on the boys than to call on the girls, or they give different kinds of feedback that they're not even aware of, affirming certain children, and behavior by a certain child will be construed as a discipline problem, whereas that same behavior by another child, the teacher will just ignore it and say it's not a problem. So there's so many levels at which unequal treatment can take place, including levels of which the teachers themselves are not aware. So how do you begin?
Well, it's a very, very tough kind of call. But for example, we faced a tremendous resistance even from the Dalit community when we started saying that caste and gender are the two sides of the same coin, mm-hmm. and you cannot ignore it. So when Dalits were burning their own women alive, and we took up these cases, you know, there were incidents where there was a social boycott or excommunication of the entire Navsarjan from entering that village. But we said that is non-negotiable, number one, no matter what happens, right? And slowly the perception of the people changed. And I must say that the reason we are continue to work is because there is change. When we set up the 3 primary schools 9 years back, we never had a single child in the school who was a so-called non-Dalit. Everybody said this is Dalit school. Many people came and said, you know, we want to admit our child here, provided he will be or she will be a day scholar. So they will come and go but never eat food with the other children. And we said, no, sorry, we cannot do that. Because education for us is not literacy. For us, it is a tool of social transformation, right? I must say that after 9 years, 20% of our total students are non-Dalits today. They stay in the hostel, same hostel, you know, live together and everything. Well, you know, one of the major programs that we have promoted, we have set up libraries for children in villages, more than 600 villages, we have set up children libraries. I myself, you know, write books for children. And we have 30,000 children who are members of the reading club. Every year, based on that book, we organize a theater competition of the children of the village groups. Last year, we had around 286 teams participating from villages. And we have a 10% grace mark if the group, theater group, has more than one caste. Mm-hmm. Well, therefore, the children across caste, they make one group and come. You know, is it to work with children than it is to do with the adults? You know, because, you know, children have no fear. They can tell you on your face who you are and, you know, no nonsense. Yeah. With adults, it's very rightist, you know, political and all that. Well, we have a vocational school near Ahmedabad where annually we have around 700 to 750 students and 7,564 graduates in the last 11 years in vocational school. Because these are youth and we don't want to fall back on the caste-based occupations. So we set up this. Again, now if you see, you know, you'll have more than 10%, 15% of students. Oh, sorry. This year, there were 60% of the women who were tribals for the first time of the entire population. I mean, entire student population, right? So this is, it's possible.
But you do this, just to ask for clarification, you attract people from other castes by ensuring that the quality of the education itself is very high.
Yeah.
That's it. So voluntarily they'll come because they see it as a route to economic advancement.
I mean, I always say that, you know, if you ask anybody who the Dalit is, and they will say, oh, Dalit is one who is untouchable, who is impure. And we say, you have to create that perception. To be Dalit is to be the best. Mm-hmm. In fact, we redefine what a Dalit means and we say, Dalit is not an identity which is based on caste. Dalit is a moral position of people who believe in equality. Therefore, all those people who believe in equality, all those who practice equality, and all those who protest against inequality are Dalits. Mm-hmm. And when I go to large conferences and I ask people, okay, raise your fingers for non-Dalits. And everybody shy to, you know, raise their fingers, right? So to say that I'm a non-Dalit, I should be ashamed. That should be treated as, you know, a sign of backwardness. That's what I redefine it, right? And then number one, quality. But number one is a righteous approach. That equality is the core value of any of your programs. A non-negotiable core value, right? And I think that's what, you see, we did this major census in Gujarat in 2010, 1,569 villages on how much untouchability persists. In 55% of the government schools today, Dalit children are seated separately when it comes to midday meal. In Gujarat, I'm not talking of states like Bihar, Uttar Pradesh, you know, which are considered very, very poor and backward. No, this is Gujarat, where Gandhi was born, right? Right. And where we are getting our prime minister from, that's Gujarat, right? But it's a very tough kind of thing, you know. But I think, you know, if I tell you stories of what children are exhibiting, oh, you know, your heart will fall out and say, this is what you must do, you know. And I mean, my hope comes from the children and from the education, right?
Are there other questions for Martin?
Sure.
I'm Britton from the Asia Pacific Regional Office. You mentioned that everybody wants the Dalit vote and that's not untouchable. And you know, you hear that the Dalit vote is courted and counted, but then there's no accountability on these promises that are made. So they're voted into office and then they're never held accountable for the promises they make to the Dalit communities when they get there. Do you do any work around accountability, or can you give an instance of where somebody was voted into office and then sort of shoved that off in Gujarat?
Well, one of the reasons why the Dalit politicians don't like me, Dalit politicians, majority of them, because I have given a call for abolition of reservation from the political sphere. Because of reservation, which is in proportion to your population, we have 84 members of parliament out of 542 sitting in the parliament. But when it comes to manual scavenging, when it comes to land reforms, when it comes to implementation of minimum wages, nobody raises their voice. Ambedkar never wanted reservation in the first place. You know, he had advocated something which is called separate electorate, which means that you hold election into two kind of systems in a primary, only Dalit candidates and only Dalit voters. You elect a panel and the general population will elect one out of that to ensure that the person elected is loyal to your masses. today, out of 542 constituencies, you know, there are constituencies where Muslims are in dominance, I mean, by majority population, tribals are, but not a single constituency where Dalits form a majority. And therefore, to be elected, you have to depend on the general population, right? And this is why, well, the vulnerability comes. In fact, you know, my biggest, saddest experience was when I was as a national convener for India, leading the delegation of almost 300 people to Durban for the conference against racism. The government of India sent 7 members of parliament and all Dalits to say that we have no untouchability because we outlawed the whole thing, and caste is not race, and therefore it should not be discussed here. Right? And but that we see, you know, and well, the thing is, I mean, but that discontent is steadily rising with the community, and people are holding them accountable, saying, what are you doing, right? But you see, it is, you know, they get their protection from the state, right? And you know, they want a candidate to be elected, you know, who may not protest at all. Now, this is a very, very sad reality, and therefore, in my opinion, unless and until we do the abolition of reservation, at least in the political sphere, they won't come to senses. You know, I believe that only when you have insecurity on your head that you become creative. You know, we have to do that, you know. I hope I have answered your question.
Are there any questions? My colleagues on the phone in London, I know it's end of day for you, but do you have any questions?
We're still here. Thank you very much for that quite inspiring but totally upsetting input. But I just wondered how much linkages there were across the country, Martin, with groups that were doing similar work on this. And does it happen usually across sectors? Because you're working on a wide range of social sectors. If you could give us some idea of the landscape of groups doing work in this area.
Oh, sure, that's a very good question. And, you know, I think the World Conference Against Racism provided us a beautiful platform where groups working on the caste issue, whether you were Dalit group or a non-Dalit group, came together, because we said that caste is not a Dalit issue, it's a national issue. And post-Durban, we have a very, very serious engagement and a very consistent one with several groups working across. So now, Sajan, for example, you know, we may not have our program like what I described in other states, but now Sajan does a lot of work traveling to all other states and training the activists, not only India. I mean, I have held maybe 3 programs in Nepal to train the Dalit activists and leaders in Nepal, right? We built an alliance with the Roma community and some of the so-called the half-caste groups from the African continent, right? But that's what we do. But let me also say that post-Durban, we realized that you may not have visible events like conferences, which becomes a platform where people can come together. How do you keep up the visibility? And therefore, we set up 2 large institutions in India. One is called the Indian Institute of Dalit Studies, which is the prime body of doing research on the question of caste. In 10 years, it has become a very, very powerful body, and including Government of India seeking its help to, you know, formulate their own policies, and also the funding agencies, you know, like UNICEF. We had a, you know, large conference with the UNICEF where some of their officers said that caste was not a concern to them, and then we put that data and evidence. They commissioned, you know, a study, and then they felt that caste is something that they must include. Several examples. So yes, we have a very powerful and very consistent program. The second organization we set up is called Dalit Foundation. It's a small funding agency which is helping very, very small groups across the country into almost 14 states. If I remember correctly, we have around 267 partners, right? Where not only we give some financial assistance, but a perspective on how do you work on the question of caste. So let's have a uniform approach, you know, then the impact is much better. Well, that's what I could say, and I hope I have answered your question.
And where does
Thank you very much.
Where does the Dalit Foundation get its money from?
Well, initially, you know, the first kind of 10 grants that we gave, we raised the money from the community. So we went to several villages and asked the people whether people will donate. And people donated almost like ₹500,000, you know. And that was the first grants that came. But then Ford Foundation came in a big way and gave us a grant and corpus also, right? And then definitely the Tatas joined in, Ratan Tata Trust. And there was a small contribution also from, I think, American Jewish World Service, AJWS. I think now we're trying to get in touch with Missouri or, you know, German, this thing. So now slowly, you know, it's been coming in. But now we are making a huge kind of reorganization of Dalit Foundation where, you know, every partner, say, maybe working in 20 villages, we are training 2 volunteers from each of those villages in vocational education at our center and also in social perspective. So end of the year, you'll have a large cadre of volunteers in every village. You know, that's the kind of approach we are taking nationally.
I did have another proper question. So my name is Sanjay Patel. I work with the public health program here at OSA. You mentioned reservations and your concern related to them. Does that concern also apply to the reservations in the civil service and in educational institutions? Because, you know, I mean, it's a very controversial subject in India. And with respect to education, because, and I apologize for missing the first portion of your talk because I had another meeting, but I suspect that you talked about the importance of education as an equalizer. And so I'd just be curious as to get your thoughts on quotas within the educational and civil service sectors.
Well, I've been visiting a scholar to several universities in India, and including National Judicial Academy, which trains judges and everything. The first question of my presentation is, what are your thoughts on reservation? You know, because it's become a very contentious issue in India. But I say my personal view so far as reservation in education and civil service are concerned. So far as caste is going to remain in the country, the reservation is going to continue. Let me say why I have taken that position. You know, almost 50% of children of the Dalit community, they drop out before they reach grade 7. And the girl child dropout rate is something like 64%, right? If you don't have a very strong constitutional measures like reservation, people stand no chance, right? In a, you know, Gandhian model which was based on conscience, right? Let me give you an example. Some villages have a program, civil society program, saying the best performing students of the village will be honored. So they'll be given a prize and a bouquet and, you know, a lecture and everything. Well, in that village, when it happened that a Dalit child was the first one to stand apart in the exams, they stopped the program. Right? Now, so the prejudices run very deep. Right? And I think so far as those prejudices are going to concern, that protection needs to continue. I mean, today, Dalit, you know, as a social class has made a difference because it's representation in terms of its proportion in civil services, right? And that's very important, right? So my views are like this, very clear that they will continue so far as the caste continues, and therefore the country must resolve to abolish the caste, right? And once the caste is not there, we don't need reservations. In India, now you'll hear demands from Brahmins who have applied for reservations, saying, you know, we are the backward class. Right? Or the Meena community, which is the largest group in Rajasthan, they had a long agitation, you know, saying, you know, we are also, you know, we need reservation because we are poor, right? And so instead of abolition of reservation, you know, now the counter demand is happening where everybody is saying, you know, we need reservation because that is the only constitutional measure which guarantees equality, equal opportunity, which is a fundamental right, you know, 15-4 or something in the constitution, right? So, you know.
But it's interesting to hear you say that reservations will continue as long as caste continues, because in the U.S. the experience has been different in the sense that affirmative action programs are starting to get rolled back, even though, you know, it's clear racism still exists in this country. So it's interesting to hear you confident that this will continue, even though the politics may shift and change. You're confident that this system will remain intact.
Yeah, I mean, I've been interacting with a lot of groups in the U.S. also, and not that they're very happy about the U.S. policy.
Right,
and they say the same things, you know, that because Obama can become the president, that doesn't mean the end of discrimination, of racial discrimination. The disparities continue, you know. And I think there are several studies, you know. And yes, I mean, it's a very, very tough calling, you know. You know, how do you handle a country with 1.25 billion population with such diversity? But unless you have a system in place, no way you can guarantee equal rights to the people. You know, that's a very sad reality.
Last burning question.
Martin, I think we know each other. This is Vinay with Public Health Program and soon to be working with India Program too. You have an intimate knowledge of the Dalit politics in terms of the civil society movements that are happening within India. If you look at next 5 to 10 years, what do you think are the most challenging issues that are dividing the community as a whole, and what do you think are some of the sort of weaknesses of the movement in terms of what it wants, what it set out to achieve, and despite such huge mobilization, of what it has been able to achieve?
Well, I think one of the major challenges that we are facing is there's a talk around the corner that the new government wants to bring an amendment in the constitution to do away with a concept called secularism. Right? Already the non-political bodies such as RSS were very strong, have kept on saying that there's nothing wrong in saying, claiming that we are a Hindu nation. Right? One of the position like of the, you know, the Vishwa Hindu Parishad during the World Conference Against Racism was caste system, abolition of caste is violation of our rights. That's the kind of position they took. So, you know, those are those kind of challenges. But to me, at the ground level, the challenge is something in education. The divide in society was between those who have and those who did not. Now, technology, access to technology and quality education is becoming the platform for this increasing gap in society, right? So, I mean, government policies such as in Gujarat, like no formal evaluation in the school and automatic upgradation of the student until you reach grade 7. Now, nobody knows what progress the student makes or the teachers do in the class. Now, these children, most government schools are meant for Dalit, tribal and the poor children. Those who have money, they go to private schools. Suddenly, when they come to grade 8, they see science, mathematics, English, and they're totally out of blue. Right? And this is where, you know, I mean, almost all the girls drop out, you know, those who are not, you know, in those villages where the school is above grade 7. So these are my concerns, you see. And the other concern is everybody talking that, you know, you should have a development model. The thesis is if you generate more capital, it may, you know, flow to the stream downwards, something to the poor people. Well, our experience world over is that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. You know, unless you have a very, very strong constitution measures, right, that doesn't happen. So, I mean, there's a growing protest against reservation, you know, against some of the policies and the programs.
Social protection programs.
Right. But that is where, you know, people must have to come together. And I would say that the danger we will run if Dalit becomes an exclusive kind of identity in society. No, it must be an inclusive, integrated approach. and therefore scheduled caste, as we call it, tribes, the Muslims, you know, the gender, you know, all must come together, right? And I mean, within the Dalit community also, the kind of opportunity the boys will have, the girls definitely does not have, right? And so, you know, those are the major challenges, you know, we are going to face, right? Slowly people, you know, are no more talking about land reforms. All the land is easily given. I mean, government has policies that if the industry wants to come and set up something, they do not even need permission of the government to turn the land into non-agriculture. They may start industry and then apply. But if a person wants to do that, it takes several years. You know, and look, you know the nano car, which is the kind of, Tata companies which brought the car to Gujarat. Government gave them 1100 acres of land at 1/10 of the market price and 10,000 crores, which is 100,000 million rupees, as a capital incentive. Of course, they call it a soft loan, and the rate of interest is 0.1% with a 20-year moratorium. You don't have to pay interest. But the scavengers, if they want to go to the bank and ask for a small loan of 5,000 rupees for their rehabilitation, they must pay an interest which is 7%. But these are some of the policies, you know, which are, you know, so people believe, no, let's have development, you know. And I think that's way back in, Gandhi and the Congress passed a resolution that let us put aside the agenda of the social reform and focus only on national independence. Because moment we become independent, we have the power to make the laws what we want, and we'll achieve equality in no time. And Ambedkar said, look at the history of the world, it has never happened anywhere. You have to have a parallel of the national independence movement and the social reform agenda, right? And I think he proves to be right, right? So that's what I would say.
Thank you.
I wanted to kind of exercise my prerogative as chair, moderator, and pick up that last thing and just ask you, what do you see, given the developments over the next 5 years, given the political scene that's now set with Narendra Modi ascending to the prime ministership, what do you see that meaning for the three-pronged strategy that you outlined that NAFSAGEN has going forward? Do you see more of a focus on strengthening and educating civil society? Do you see media playing in more? Do you see litigation featuring more prominently? Or is it kind of hard to tell? Or do you see other tools coming on board? Well,
definitely. I mean, one of the major thing I see coming is the training and empowering of the youth. And therefore in Gujarat, for example, Ambedkar had started a Peace Corps kind of thing, Force for Equality, is called Samta Sainik Dal, way back in 1927. We are trying to re-strengthen that in Gujarat, right? And so we are training cadres of youth who are trained into vocational education and so the social perspective, and they are volunteers, you know, in the villages. So therefore, something happens in the village, they are the one who will take action on it immediately and don't have to wait for an organization, right? So empowering of the youth is a major program in terms of employment and social education. But my biggest second problem is the quality education, because if the younger generation which is coming, the children, if they are going to continue to be discriminated, there's very little hope, right? And no matter what happens, somehow that we must attack on a priority basis and see that there is no discrimination when it comes to children in the public schools, right? I would say that. And third, definitely, you know, I firmly believe that the tools that an operational society and the strategy that they may use to continue with the discrimination, well, those can't be my tools and strategies when I'm talking of the liberation, right? And to me, therefore, you know, in NAFSAGEN we have been advancing this thing that without women's leadership, no social movement can succeed. And therefore, let women take the leadership, because that's what we have seen from experience, that all the initiatives you see have been coming from the women. Not because of any other reason, but they are the ones. I believe that, you know, to be able to fight oppression, you need a very deep kind of experience. And women as a group are the ones who are the most oppressed section in Indian society. Right? Well, that I think is to us is something non-negotiable. And definitely a continuous process of political education of what's happening, right? And how do we use the technology to, because now, you know, you can't have those programs like I used to do 35 years back, going to the village and living there for 3 days and three nights. You have to use technology and means of mass communication to be effective, right? So how does one do that? I think those kind of search would be, you know, I think our priorities and list, I mean, agenda kind of thing in future.
Thank you, Martin. Unless there are last burning questions. Martin, I want to say thank you so very much again for coming and sharing with us. We look forward to thinking about how we might communicate going forward, to think about lessons that we could continue learning from you. But it's been a pleasure, I think I speak on behalf of all of us, to hear about the work that you're doing, and we look forward to hearing more of it going forward.
Thank you.
And we wish you safe travels.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.